That has already been our cold opening, so we can't use it again.
Okay. I've been doing this a long time.
We know everything you're going to say. We know all your takes.
Let's create an algorithm that creates Nate takes.
Actually, like, what's the worst kind of fish? What's the tiers of fish?
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. We are now almost 2 weeks into the impeachment inquiry, and the Ukraine story is still developing. Last week, the House began taking testimony, at least one more whistleblower came forward, and the two parties' political strategies became clearer. We also launched our impeachment polling tracker, so we're going to take a look at what happened over the past week and whether public opinion is still evolving. We're also going to assess former Vice President Joe Biden's position in the Democratic primary. Last week, Claire published a piece looking at Biden's standing with Black voters in particular and what it means for his shot at the nomination. And so here with me to discuss all of that, our Editor-in-Chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you for asking, Galen.
Senior politics writer, Claire Malone.
Hey, Galen.
Good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
We're all here,
brushing shoulders with each other.
Although you can only see that we're brushing shoulders if you're watching this on ABC News Live.
Which you should be.
And, of course, also with us is managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Hello, hello.
So let's begin with the Ukraine story and the impeachment inquiry. It's been a busy 7 days since we last met. Let me lay out some of the key developments, and then we'll dig into it all. Last Wednesday, the former special envoy to Ukraine testified to Congress and shared text messages between diplomats debating whether Trump's pressuring Ukraine to investigate the Bidens amounted to a quid pro quo. We also found out that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on the Zelensky call and that Chair of the Intelligence Committee Adam Schiff falsely said his office hadn't been in touch with the whistleblower before the complaint was filed. And Trump had two angry press availabilities where he lashed out while the Finnish president mostly watched. We're still on Wednesday. On Thursday, President Trump publicly called on China to investigate the Bidens. On Friday, Democrats subpoenaed the White House after it did not meet the deadline for voluntarily turning over documents related to their investigation. And then over the weekend, we found out that at least one more whistleblower came forward. The person is described as an intelligence official with firsthand knowledge of Trump's calls with Ukraine. So of the developments I just mentioned, or anything that I forgot to mention, Claire, what's the most significant news in the Ukraine story since last week?
Well, I guess it's always the latest thing, right? My mom always says that my dad would say, whenever she cooked a meal when they first got married, this is the best meal I've ever had. And I kind of feel like with the Ukraine story, it's like, this is the best piece of information I've ever had because it's the latest development. So I think it is significant, at least in my mind, that there is reportedly a new whistleblower, a second whistleblower, who has firsthand experience with some of these phone calls or whatever instances where the president was talking about Ukraine, whereas the first whistleblower was essentially sort of fact-finding and getting secondhand information. And in some ways, the fact that there's now a second whistleblower, there are text messages, it's kind of undercutting some of the Trump administration's first line about this, which is the first whistleblower is just getting all this stuff secondhand. It's hearsay. Who would trust this person?
Deep state operator.
Yeah, exactly. And so now it seems like, oh, okay, well, that's even more evidence in the arsenal.
I think the two things Claire highlighted there are totally right. One, the second whistleblower. Two, those text messages that came to light. And both, I think, I go back to that moment between when the White House released the call summary and the actual whistleblower complaint came out. And what was really significant about that complaint was just how robust it alleged both the White House dealings with Ukraine about all this were and how many people it alleged were sort of involved in it. And the text messages and the second whistleblower kind of both point to that and kind of, I don't know, you know, it just like increases the risk to Trump by an order of magnitude, sort of.
Are we any closer to establishing whether or not there was a quid pro quo? And is that the key piece here? Or does it not really matter whether or not you can say the military aid and pressuring Ukraine to investigate the Bidens are linked?
They are trying to figure that out. And I think it certainly matters in that it would add to the list of potential impeachable offenses Democrats think Trump has committed. But even without a quid pro quo, Democrats think they have impeachable offenses list.
Right.
The other thing is, in the text messages, the quid pro quo thing kind of became more complicated, or there was more than one
quid pro quo.
Exactly. So the text messages lay out a scenario where the White House was holding out a meeting with the Ukrainian president in exchange for, you know, them to start this investigation,
right,
both of the Bidens and of the 2016 election. Has that proved that quid pro quo? Well, maybe not yet.
Although the text messages are more, they more fulsomely explore that particular quid pro quo, the idea that the Ukrainian president really wanted and in some ways, like, I think politically needed this
the
show
meeting.
Of yeah. partnership with the United States. And so there are communications that basically illustrate that the White House or White House advisors or American advisors were saying, okay, but we need to see that you've started this investigation first before we set the meeting. And the Ukrainians kind of pushing back, frankly, in a bit of sort of ideal little like deal making, like hard driving bargaining, being like, no, we need to set the meeting before we open this Biden investigation. It was kind of an interesting, like, revealing look at kind of.
No, the behind yeah. the diplomatic scenes. And of course, none of that would be unusual if not for the fact that what they were haggling over was sort of like
investigation of a political adversary.
Right. It wasn't like something in the U.S. interest. It was something in Trump's political interest.
And it's also worth just saying here, these text messages are between the special envoy to Ukraine, which is Kurt Volker, who testified on Wednesday, and then also the ambassador to the European Union appointed by President Trump.
And what amounts to the kind of local Ukrainian ambassador, even though we don't have an ambassador to Ukraine. But I would draw this, the text messages do not support or do not provide evidence for a quid pro quo with regards to the military money. Mm-hmm. So what you see in those text messages is lots of suggestion of a quid pro quo for the meeting. I mean, that's all up in there, right? Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting is you have Sondland, who was a major Republican fundraiser who Trump appointed as the ambassador to the EU. In these text messages, you get the feeling he's kind of playing the role as like the Trump ally, right? He sort of seems to have Trump's back. And then this guy Taylor, William B. Taylor Jr., the top American diplomat in Ukraine, he's sort of increasingly, you get the feeling he's like increasingly frustrated and exasperated. And towards the end, so why I say that, you know, I would draw the line at, okay, this is evidence for quid pro quo for a meeting, but not the military aid, is towards the end of the exchange, there's all these hints from Taylor in which he almost seems to be like trying to get these guys to go on the record saying, hey, we're holding out military aid in exchange for these investigations. But reportedly, he thought that, I can't remember where I saw this, but reportedly he thought that due to news reports, not because he had inside information. So I would be really cautious there. But Taylor is pushing on that line, and then all of a sudden the response from the kind of pro-Trump guy, the Sondland, is like this press release style, hey, everybody is going to see these text messages one day.
It's a pretty, honestly, like, kudos to Gordon, because that was quite some, like, good legal.
He was like, to be clear, there is no quid pro quo. Let's continue this conversation by phone.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Like, so, Gordon is someone you want on your cover-up team.
No, and earlier in the...
Not to say that there's been a cover-up.
earlier in the exchange, there is this part where Taylor, again, the local diplomat, says, are you now saying that security assistance and White House meeting are conditioned on investigations, ? And Sondland is just like, call me. And then, but anyway, later, Taylor says, as I said on the phone, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with the political campaign. And Sondland writes, quote, Bill, I believe you are incorrect about President Trump's intentions. The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind. The president is trying to evaluate whether Ukraine is truly going to adopt the transparency and reforms that President Zelensky promised during his campaign. I suggest we stop the back and forth by text. If you still have concerns, I recommend you give blah, 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 blah.
I mean, that's what I, you know, when anyone tries to talk about you guys in Slack,
that's
my response. I suggest we take this up on private text mode.
I have not had a chance to land on this, and I think you guys are kind of a little off the mark.
What? Like, we have literally been describing the situation, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what your counterintuitive take is on this. Go ahead.
There's no counter to it. I just think that, look, the facts that were established in, like, the first week of, like, the White House transcript showing Trump, by their own admission, pressuring the president of Ukraine on Joe Biden, and then his declaration in front of TV cameras this week that not only Ukraine, but also China should investigate Joe Biden, right? I mean, I think, obviously, two whistleblowers, or is it whistleblower? Anyway, you know,
like attorneys general. Wait, so you're saying that just President Trump standing out on the White House lawn calling for China to investigate the Bidens is more significant than these text messages or the second whistleblower or whatever?
I'm sure there's a little quid in that pro quo somewhere, right? And I think those text messages were quite damaging. But what I'm trying to do is, like, how does, like, a news junkie follow the story versus how does the average American follow the
story? But here's the thing, Nate. I don't think that the second whistleblower and the text messages were the biggest deal, because in this moment, they're this huge thing that changed the nature of the story. I think they're a big deal because of what they say about the eventual end of this scandal, right?
So I hear you, Nate. And let me give you this.
I represent the voice of the normal person.
Cool.
First of all, you sure do, man,
with opinions about sous vide.
I was asked about sous vide. I didn't volunteer those.
Okay, Before this podcast began, Nate, you said to me, encrusted was so 10 years ago about fish. That is not the voice of the normal
person.
Okay,
but Nate, I'm gonna be the wall in wall ball, and you can. I'm giving you space to bounce something off of. So people have said, okay, Trump goes on the White House lawn and calls on all these other governments to investigate Biden. And by doing so, it's actually sort of the same thing he's been doing for the past 3 years, which is muddying the water and making something which is an abuse of power seem like the norm. And if he does it enough, it'll become a regular thing and people won't think that he was abusing his office. Respond.
Yeah, so I think that reflects a flaw in how the media covers the story. And I think it reflects a flaw in Democrats' messaging, right? You know, you had Kamala Harris and Joe Biden this week saying in slightly different ways, like, oh, I don't know if I would convict in the Senate. We have to see the evidence, right? Apart from being, I think, a dumb strategy as far as being a presidential candidate, I think it's also a dumb strategy as far as Democrats' messaging, right? They should be saying that, like, look, the case is already made, right? That based on the transcript the White House released, that's already impeachable behavior. And so you set expectations low, and anything else on top of it will make things seem worse, right? But, like,
but then don't you also hear them criticizing Republicans for coming out and saying, like, you know, it maybe wasn't the best thing to do as president, but it's not an impeachable offense. And then Democrats are saying, well, if you're going to be involved in this impeachment inquiry in the Senate, you can't already decide that he's innocent.
Yeah, I think Democrats want voters to think of the impeachment investigation as serious and statesmanlike and staid, and they don't want them to view it as to use the president's phrase, a partisan witch hunt. Now, maybe that's a kind of naive hope, but to that end, I think it is in their interest, at least some of them, maybe not the presidential candidates, to kind of play the role of neutral juror.
But if you calibrate expectations such that, again, the public has seen the evidence, right? If you calibrate expectations such that, okay, there has to be some new and spectacular news development because probably the news isn't going to, I mean, I actually don't know what this story, maybe it would. Probably the news isn't going to keep spinning out of control for Trump as spectacularly as it did in the first 2 weeks here. Maybe it will.
Maybe, yeah.
Every story has a shelf or a half-life, sort of. And everyone's expectations adjust eventually. You know, I don't know. I do kind of think, like, oh, he kind of normalizes it. I think that theory is maybe too cute by half, but half of me does think it's cute.
Oh, cute.
All right. Well, I want to get into what updated information we have about public opinion and get further into the two-party strategies here. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Honey. Ever buy something online and then find out you could have gotten it for less? It's worse than a bad use of polling. Not to mention, once it happens, you feel like you could be overpaying every time you shop. Luckily, there's Honey, a free browser extension that saves you time and money when shopping online. Honey scans the internet for coupon codes and other discounts, then like magic, it automatically applies the one with the biggest savings to your cart at checkout. It knows about every coupon code, sale, or discount at over 20,000 sites like Amazon, Macy's, J.Crew, Domino's, Sephora, Target, and more. Just shop like normal, and then Honey finds you savings. It feels amazing, like the best use of polling. Honey has found its 10 million users over $1 billion in savings. Listen, there's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and install on your computer in just two clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/538. That's joinhoney, H-O-N-E-Y, .com/538. We're back, and since we last met a week ago and talked about public opinion, we launched our impeachment tracker. So, Nate, I want to get a sense of whether or not public opinion is still evolving or getting more in favor of impeachment, or whether it's stabilized since the last time we talked, and now we have a tracker to help us out. So what's the political forecast look like?
We don't know.
Tell me more.
Here's a short answer. We currently have 46.5% support for impeachment, 44.8% say don't impeach. That's for actually impeachment itself, not for hearings. There are people who think hearings are a good idea, but not yet impeachment. We didn't get a ton of high-quality polling like late last week, so I just think we don't know if it's still moving or if the numbers have hit some type of a steady state. I think there's one YouGov poll that seemed to show further growth in support for impeachment. But by the time you listen to this podcast, depending on what day it is, there'll probably be a couple more high-quality national polls that test this in more detail.
Is that good news for Democrats? You know, 1 or 2 points in favor of impeachment, a slim plurality of Americans, is that good enough for them?
I mean, so you have not seen any overall increase in the president's approval rating, which might be the bottom line, right? Because it's not that surprising that, like, the impeachment number and the approval rating are converging, but so far all the convergence has been that the impeachment numbers have gotten worse for Trump. The approval rating has not gotten better. In fact, in some polls, it's down like a point or two. And so I'd say so far it's going pretty well for Democrats. I think if it stalled out here, then that would be a little disappointing for Democrats. I think they would think that, like, okay, well, we have a plurality here versus a clear majority of people who disapprove of Trump, but I don't know. I don't think there's, like, I mean, I'm someone who is skeptical about, I think it would have been risky, and risky can mean two things, right? It can mean like high variance, or it can mean like a bad risk. And I mean, kind of in both senses of that term, I think, to have impeached over the Mueller report, given that the Mueller report did not deliver what the Democrats wanted, which people seem to forget about, I think that would have been politically very risky. I think the risks are pretty balanced, and they're also intangible benefits for Democrats, like Trump is acting.
So let me jump
not
in.
Not very soberly, one might say.
Let me jump here and in here and ask, you know, not to be a regional essentialist about American elections, but the Electoral College does force.
Here we go, Ohio.
No, but yeah, you're right. The Electoral College does make us think more about states in the Upper Midwest, right? So Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and my question is, doesn't it only really matter in some ways what people in, I'm using these states as a stand-in for, you know, the swing voter, the swing states, the swing places. Doesn't it only really matter what those people think about impeachment? And do we have any polling about it?
You're embedding like five complicated issues in there.
Unpack it.
You know, issue number one is like, what are the swing states, which I think we're not ready to get into on this particular edition of the podcast.
Ooh, not teaser.
Nate is going to say it's Texas.
I've gotten some fights about this year. I think it's a mistake to focus too much on like state-level polling data at this point. We're too far out from the election. It's too noisy. There's not enough granularity in the data. And so, yeah, you're probably best off looking at national numbers, assuming that states track the national numbers according to their partisan lean, and that Trump probably has an advantage in the Electoral College, which, you know, is maybe as big as last time, maybe a little smaller, maybe a little bigger. I lean more toward reversion to the mean. But no, yeah, in principle, if we had like super high quality polling every day from every state, you could look at that. But we don't. And so I think kind of not wanting to get too cute about it. But yeah, I don't know. I would wonder what those proverbial white working class voters would think.
I think that's a good question. I think Nate's right. We don't have enough data yet. But to your original question, Galen, I think probably where public opinion is now, which is like marginally in favor of impeachment, and Trump's approval rating is still in the low 40s, that's probably good enough for Democrats to avoid a backlash to impeachment, but not good enough for them to remove Trump from office, right? Which is something, as Nate said, if they had impeached over the Russia investigation, I think the most likely outcome would have been you would have seen people move against that.
What do you think that line is where disapproval of Trump or support of impeachment could get to where enough Republicans, say 20 Republicans in the Senate, would break ranks and actually remove the president from office?
I have no idea.
I mean,
the best we can say is like Nixon's approval rating was like in the high 20s towards the end, 25% at the end. So Trump's a long way from there.
I mean, one relatively direct way would be if they actually think that replacing Trump on the ticket would make them more likely to win a second term, then.
But that's a pretty, yes, but that's also pretty high. That's a far
do you
way
think?
To fall.
I saw somebody poll the Pence versus the Democrats.
And how did it look?
In Ohio, according to Emerson College, not that we should only focus on Ohio, God, but Warren was beating Pence by 2, Sanders was beating Pence by 3, and Biden was beating Pence by 8.
And
as opposed to Warren was beating Trump by 3, so Warren does 1 point better against Trump than Pence. Sanders was beating Trump by 6, so Sanders does 3 points better against Trump than against Pence.
Yeah.
And Biden was beating Trump by 5. So Biden does 3 points worse against Trump than Pence.
And it's also,
I wouldn't read that much into that, but that's
it's worth saying here, too, that Democrats have not been necessarily campaigning against Pence for the past 3 years, right? So public opinion would change a lot once an actual campaign got underway. But obviously, that is all very far-fetched still at this point. We published a piece on the website, actually, this week about why Republicans have been so cohesive and not really broken ranks on this issue. What, and it's maybe more than just polling numbers, right? Why
I mean, have
Republicans
they been
are,
I don't know.
So that, so let's get into that. I thought about this a lot over the weekend, and I think it's wrong to
lame
say
weekend.
Literally, that sentence was like 3/4 out of my mouth, and I was like,
I'm so sorry.
No, you're right. So, the most predominant talking points from Republicans so far on Ukraine have been silence. They've just tried to avoid talking about it, saying, oh, no, the president was joking. I mean, specifically, that was mostly about what the president said to the press about.
Classic Marco Rubio.
Yeah, that was from Marco Rubio saying he's just trying to, you know, get you guys going in the press.
Rubio and I think it was either Jim Jordan or Mark Meadows did it too. A couple other people are just like, ah, oh, you guys don't take him so seriously. And then you have seen some people come out and say, no, this is all fine, or at least like this isn't worth impeaching over.
Or and let's investigate the Bidens. You know, this is important.
Right.
What
right,
Trump is
exactly.
trying to do, we need to, you know, seek out where corruption is around the world and challenge.
So that's not exactly a rousing defense of the president of your party from your caucus, right? If one of the main responses is silence and another one is this like really feeble attempt to call it a joke, that's like pretty underwhelming.
No,
actually.
This whole time they haven't been able to settle on a defense and they're a little contradictory, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the least worst defense is probably like this is bad but it's not impeachable.
Or not to
which,
say
yeah, it's, yeah, and their whole thing is basically like, this is just his demeanor. Like, it all kind of comes back to sort of their defense around right before the election and when, like, Access Hollywood came out. It was like, yeah, like, he's just this kind of guy.
But
in his heart of hearts, he didn't mean to
ask
a foreign country to intervene to find dirt on his political opponent.
You've seen a lot of GOP criticism over Trump's decision in Syria.
Yes, this morning.
I do wonder if...
For context, he tweeted that he wanted to pull out
Northern
troops.
Syria.
Yeah.
Tweeted some threatening language toward Turkey, and if they don't take care of business. Anyway, I mean, I think a scenario where Republicans could move toward actually thinking about removing him, that's maybe too far ahead of ourselves, but actually thinking about kind of criticizing him more head-on would be if like they begin to feel like they're not getting their way on
policy,
other issues, right? I think it would be a dumb time for Trump, for example, to escalate sanctions against China, not sanctions.
Just going back to what Republicans feel like they can, where they can speak counter to Trump, it often happens over these foreign policy issues. So like Lindsey Graham has already publicly come out this morning against Trump's decision, but it's also I'm a cynic about whether or not the American public will
care.
Yeah. And I think that matters because at the end of the day, those Republicans are responding to their constituents and what their constituents care more about, right? Like Trump and the Republican domestic agenda or the foreign policy
agenda. So they can break with Trump on issues where voters are not really paying attention or deeply invested, but on more core Trump domestic issues, they're sticking with him.
Right. And if our argument is, well, if Republicans stop getting what they want on trade or China or whatever, that could be the place where they go against Trump. Okay, maybe. But also you have to sell that to your Republican constituents, right? And I do think that that's still an uphill battle for them because the Trump brand, you know, cult of political personality, whatever you want to call it, is pretty strong.
Well, let me ask you guys this. Let's say, and this isn't going to happen, but let's just pretend for a second. Let's say tomorrow every Republican in the Senate came out and said, I'm for removal. The next day, the House impeaches. The day after that, Republican, you know, the Senate votes. Trump is out of office in a week. Mm-hmm. Okay. All of a sudden, Pence is president. Pence is on the top of the ticket for 2020. How much power do you think Trump would have over Republican voters? Because I was reading something and they were like,
after he's impeached?
If he's out of office. The idea was like, look, Trump has a lot of power over the Republican base while he's the leader of the party, while he's president. Once he's out of office.
It's an interesting question because
thank you, Claire.
Yeah.
I spent my weekend thinking about it.
You're an interesting thinker, Mike. You should maybe consider this professionally.
Thank you.
I don't know because it's interesting because so much of what Trump was able to do in, say, turning around the Republican Party platform on certain issues to be completely contrary to what they once were, I do think was done on the force of his personality and the force of his both like, oh, Trump being Trump and Trump being a really famous person and a famous blowhard for decades and decades in American life, but also Trump being the outsider and all this stuff. And so I think he would still be a political player in the Republican Party, although probably just to the base, right? If like let's take Hillary Clinton is obviously a very, very different example. But sometimes when Hillary Clinton comes out and says things now, there's certain people on the internet who react very positively to it, right?
Like, well, if that's the standard, I think
he would have more power, right? Because you could see the people being, you could see him, it's almost like a martyrdom complex, right? He was removed from office unfairly and like, what if he became sort of this like Ross Perot spoiler?
I mean, well, actually, the only remedy that the House and Senate have in terms of punishment that goes along with impeachment is preventing somebody from ever holding public office again. They can't actually imprison somebody or fine them or whatever, but you can bar them from running for public office again.
I mean,
for whatever that's worth.
I'm having trouble with this scenario because, like, the notion of Republicans just spontaneously deciding they should impeach him.
But it's like a dinner party scenario. You have to go with it. You can't question the ground rules. Come on.
I think it would be very difficult for the Republican Party. I think they would feel like, you know, voters would feel like they had been betrayed.
Yeah. Wait, can we bring this back to real life for a second?
No.
I just want to ask, though, we're kind of like going down this rabbit hole a little bit of Republicans rejecting Trump. Why isn't the best strategy to say we're opposed to corruption? Trump was trying to root out corruption abroad. The Bidens were corrupt. We wanted this. We think it's good to investigate this. And just, I mean, some of this stuff is rooted in conspiracy theory. But like, does that really matter for a political strategy?
So none of that is true, first of all. So that's...
Well, right. I think it's basically supporting conspiracy theories as a political strategy, which has been part of Trump's political strategy for, you know, since he got into Republican
politics.
I
do think there are enough people in the Republican Party who still won't promote a conspiracy theory that they wouldn't go along with that PR line. Is that me being too credulous?
Well, they haven't so far.
Yeah, I just kind of think that, I mean...
Some haven't so far.
Also, like, Tom Bossert, you know, former Trump administration member coming out publicly and saying, this is a conspiracy theory. It makes me angry that Trump's legal team continues to put it in its ear. Let me say clearly again, this is a conspiracy theory. When you have Republicans who they're not never Trumpers, it is literally a former member of the administration saying that. I do think you have people, I mean, these Republican senators are by and large like very smart, savvy individuals who know that there are there are real consequences for pushing something that's like completely bogus. Now, watch me have to eat my words in like a month, and like, and that becomes the new Republican Party PR line. But I do think that the idea that it is a conspiracy theory is like.
What do you think, Nate? I mean, could a just fully backing a conspiracy theory work as a strategy?
I mean,
I think to the point Claire was kind of making, I think it's hard when Republicans don't really have a limb to stand on that, like, they can kind of say without bullshitting. You know what I mean? I do think, like, just it's kind of physically hard to have to, like, lie or mislead for, like, months on end, right? And it's like there are not yet the good kind of coherent talking points that you could have had with Mueller, for example. I do wonder if that'll have, like, a cumulative effect. You know, I mean, one other effect it could have, if nothing else, is it could yield a few more retirements for Republicans, which is already an issue for them in the House. It was a big issue for them last cycle. If you have a few more members of the House in the few swing districts the GOP still holds, that would be bad for Republicans. If you have a senator unexpectedly retire prematurely or something, that's like a risk factor for Republicans as well. But no, I would not take a ton of comfort if I were Trump from a few people, not many, you're right, not many Mitt Romneys, but a couple people are speaking out against him. A lot of people are being very quiet, and the people who are defending him seem not to have been able to make very persuasive arguments. So the sum total of that for me, if I were Trump, would not make me feel hugely great about my situation.
Can we wrap here just on Democratic strategy? I mean, there was some hiccups for Adam Schiff over the past week, and then it came out that he falsely said that, you know, we, presumably his office, had not been in touch with the whistleblower previous to the whistleblower filing that complaint. And of course, the whistleblower had been in touch with his office seeking information, details about how to go about filing that complaint and making sure that it was heard. Republicans have been also ragging on him for the way that he characterized the conversation in that initial public hearing.
Which was stupid, by the way.
Yeah, it was.
I think he likes to hear himself talk a lot.
I think we said that on the live blog, that it was weird that he was doing like a trying to be jokey tenor.
Yeah. I guess that's not the only Democratic strategy we've seen laid out. Nancy Pelosi, during her press conference, basically tried to say, our priority is still like infrastructure, trade, and prescription drugs. And then and kind of pressing the press to ask questions about those things. I mean, so far, what can you discern from what the Democratic strategy is, and does it seem to be working?
That's another great question. I don't have a sense.
I mean, to go back to what Nate was saying earlier, they have kind of competing incentives, right? One is to hit the kind of case against Trump as hard as you can, prosecute that case, and try to convince the American people you're right. The other, which kind of cuts it gets at, and I mentioned earlier, is to make people think that the impeachment process is nonpartisan, is about the facts, is serious, and they're doing it in all, you know, fairness.
We're sad, right? Nancy Pelosi says, this is a sad thing that we're doing.
Exactly, right. Doing both of those things at the same time is hard. The other two things that are hard to do at the same time is what Nate mentioned earlier, which is, one, sort of say, hey, based on this call summary alone, there's a prima facie case. How do you say that? Prima facie?
Prima facie.
Prima facie.
I believe it's a skin disease.
There's a prime face case to impeach Trump. And then on the other hand, explore and communicate the kind of other vectors of potential corruption.
Well, and they have to.
So what's the public facing? Like, how do you communicate that?
Well, I don't really know.
It does strike me that they have to be a bit probabilistic in their thinking in this sense, right? If they think that,
ooh,
like,
lay it out, Nate.
Let's say they think there's a 85% chance that
always got to have a number
that compelling evidence of a quid pro quo will come out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you might take that chance, right? Kind of slow walk a little bit and say, well, you know, it's already pretty bad. But if there were a quid pro quo, oh my gosh, then everyone would have to agree we have to impeach him then, right? And then if that hits or something, right?
And so then they walk this line of being, we're going to be deliberate, we're still looking for more information, instead of the, we already have enough information to impeach.
Again, I do think it's important context that expectations for Democrats got way ahead of themselves with the Russia investigation on multiple occasions, I think, that really dulled the impact of what Mueller eventually found. And it's kind of politics 101 in a modern media age when people react very quickly to things. But, like, I mean, if you back up, right, I mean, we're going to talk about the story probably every week for many, many weeks now. But, like, I do think, like, overall, it's going pretty well for Nancy Pelosi and Democrats. Well, she's had near uniform consensus within her caucus. Even some of the Max Roses and some of the moderates are on board.
It's now 225 out of 235 Democrats support the impeachment inquiry.
That's pretty impressive.
But how does it? So, but what does it look like? I go back to my question of what does it look like in the public campaign? So, okay, now we've got all these people who say they support opening the inquiry. The inquiry. I was trying to say it in the British way, but I shouldn't. So what does that look like? Does Pelosi go on talking about infrastructure? Does she defend Adam Schiff? What does she do? Like, and I'm not necessarily asking you guys to tell me what to do, but that's the thing that I'm very curious about, right? Is like, how do you actually continue to sell as maybe the new facts stall and stop coming out about this Ukraine stuff is, okay, so what are we doing here? Do we make every single piece of testimony like a big event, like one more accumulating evidence? Do you just hammer ahead time and again? We've already heard everything we need to impeach Trump. Godspeed, John Glenn. Let's do this.
See, I think those are probably important questions, but not the most important questions. And the most important question is like, what are the facts of the case and how do they come out?
But that's one of my questions is like, is one of the things they say, we already have all the facts that we need.
I don't think they should say that.
It's like, let's have tons and let's explore the potential criminality or abuse of power.
You can kind of do both. And look, in the since this story has come to light, it has gotten nothing but worse for the administration.
Yeah.
And that's not because of something Pelosi said or something Schiff said or some screw up on Schiff's part or like the crappy 60 Minutes interview that What's-His-Face did. It's because the more facts have come out and they've been super damaging. And so that's like, as long as that's happening and there's what was significant about the whistleblower, the second whistleblower and about the text messages is both suggested that's going to continue happening for the foreseeable future. Yeah.
And they're moving quickly. I think we got somewhat of a calendar today. There are, you know, two depositions tomorrow. There's another one on Thursday. There's another two on Friday. So I guess, you know, information could be quickly coming. But we should leave things there because we will get more information and we'll talk about this, as Nate mentioned, probably week after week for the foreseeable future. But let's move on and talk about Joe Biden's position in the Democratic primary race. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. Once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. So is that hairline slowly starting to move backwards? Any bald spots yet? The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. It's time to get a handle on those precious locks. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Thanks to science, baldness can be optional. Hims was created by a guy who knows that some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today, right now while supplies last, and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's forhims.com/538. 4hims.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. Who doesn't want less stress in their life? If high interest credit card bills are adding to your stress, here's a solution. Pay off your credit card balances and save money with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay. That's much lower than the national average interest rate of over 20% APR. Plus, your rate is fixed, so as rates continue to rise, your low rate won't budge. The online application is quick and easy. You can apply right from your phone, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Listeners can apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and Joe Biden has been the national polling leader since before he entered the Democratic primary race. But is he truly the frontrunner? Claire Malone tackled exactly that question in a piece called The Frontrunner? With a question mark at the end. published on 538.com. I thought it was a good title. I like the
great,
you
know,
but
headline.
I had to make it clear that there was a question mark there. She focused in particular on Biden's biggest electoral strength, which is his popularity with black voters. Let's talk a little bit about your reporting, Claire, and what you learned. How would you characterize Biden's position in the race?
Well, I think my line about it in the piece was his lead is numerically indisputable, but plausibly fatally flawed. And some of that comes from Joe Biden has obviously had a summer that was peppered with sort of verbal missteps and focusing on his record about race. The core base of his support is black voters. And black voters are obviously a demographic within the Democratic primary electorate that you really need to win over. And so it was kind of examining all the reasons why black voters in particular, but people who are sympathetic to Biden's campaign, why they are sympathetic to Biden. A lot of it has to do with Obama. A lot of it has to do with people wanting a more moderate candidate in the Democratic Party and not seeing that in other candidates, but also exploring ways that he could falter and cracks that are showing a little bit in his campaign. And some of it has to do with he doesn't do very well with, let's say, young voters or very liberal voters. I mean, some Democrats basically see Joe Biden as like a Republican, right? So the idea that he was once Uncle Joe, right? But that reputation has sort of shifted somewhat. And we have seen in the past couple of weeks, Elizabeth Warren obviously creeping up on him in the polls and kind of examining, like, why? What is it that makes him numerically in the lead for months and months and months, but also people still seem to be sort of searching around, not quite sure about Biden?
And just to lay it out there, I think Biden's been hovering around 30% in the national polls for much of the summer, is now down to maybe 26 in the national polling average. But how strong is Biden's black support? You said that you're starting to see some cracks. Is it with black voters? Where are his vulnerabilities?
Yeah, so I followed Biden around to a couple of events in the Midwest, in Michigan and Indiana, ended up spending a couple of days in South Carolina. And what you hear and again from people is, if Biden was good enough for Obama on race stuff, it's good enough for me. But then you do also hear people starting to say, a lot of people would say, you know, I don't believe a lot of the attacks on Biden's historical record are fair. This is coming from black voters. But they were basically starting to say other candidates were really interesting to them. And someone like Elizabeth Warren did keep on coming up as a name that was, all right, I really like her. But people kept on coming back to the electability question. And that really, I think, is a core part of black support for Biden. Just support for Biden in general among Democrats who do support him is the fact that there is a perception that Biden is the person best equipped to appeal to voters, those swing voters we were talking about, right? Those perhaps, to stereotype them, white voters in the upper Midwest. And I think a lot of black voters are sort of in some ways used to thinking strategically about who they want to put their support behind. And it was just sort of interesting to talk to people about the reasons for supporting Biden and their reasons, even if they liked other candidates, why they weren't throwing their support behind those candidates.
Yeah, why don't you think that some of these hiccups over the summer and questioning his history related to policy on race hasn't shaken more of his black support?
Well, it's interesting. Again, so his support is much stronger with older black voters. And you heard a lot from regular people on the ground that, listen, it was a different time, right? And people did bring up high rates of crime, you know, basically saying the context was different. I don't think he should be punished for his opinions of years past. You're sort of getting the idea that older black voters might see Biden more in the context of the period, whereas younger voters in general and younger black voters in particular, perhaps there's a greater focus on social justice issues. So school to prison pipelines, the effect that these long sentences for drugs had on certain communities, and they sort of see Biden's record only through 2019 eyes. And that's actually something that has become a point of weakness for the Biden campaign. And it's become also a point of fixation for them. So they spend a lot of time trying to defend his historical record on race, which sometimes makes for sort of awkward interactions when people are kind of saying, well, how do we move forward, right? How do we move forward? And Biden does have to do a lot of, or feels compelled to do a lot of defense of his record on race.
Yeah, there was a scene at a university that you described where, you know, somebody asked him about a current issue relating to race, and his whole answer was basically defending his historical record. Anyway, I want Micah and Nate, get in here. Like, what do you, I know you've read the piece, what do you make of,
I don't know if Nate
does. I skipped it. What
do you make of the front runner question mark? Is Joe Biden the front runner, and like, do we see his black support holding?
Pull back the curtain a little bit for readers. Usually what we do is, Claire writes a wonderful piece like this. For any piece, though, we put a link to it in our headline channel in Slack, and then people offer suggestions for headlines, right? And so when this was in there, I thought about, and I didn't because it's a dumb idea, but I thought about suggesting the question mark in parentheses too, which doesn't make any sense.
Wait,
except
what?
So that question mark is only there because the media is disproportionately college educated and liberal, and Biden support skews non-college educated, skews non-white. Mm-hmm. And so the media is sort of constantly looking for reasons that Biden might fail. Or the converse argument is like, no, there are real questions about Biden's strength as a front runner. And I think there are real questions about Biden's strength as the front runner. But you get what I mean? It's like there are two questions there. There's questions about Biden's strength, and then I think there are questions about whether it's even fair to ask questions. I happen to think it is fair.
So first of all, Biden is one of exactly two candidates whose campaign is well positioned to win the nomination right now, the other one being Elizabeth Warren. And we can debate whether Warren or Biden is more likely to win. She has almost cut him in the various polling averages of national polls. He actually got some good state polls in Wisconsin and South Carolina over the weekend, which were kind of ignored because they don't match the narrative. Actually, one thing that is fairly basic is like the gap closing between Warren and Biden is about 80% because of Warren gaining and 20% because of Biden falling, because he hasn't actually fallen all that much. So to me, it's like a little bit weird that the media is always talking about how Biden is struggling when Bernie Sanders is polling about half of what Biden is, when Kamala Harris has fallen from 12% to like 5%, when all these candidates I thought might be serious, Amy Klobuchar or Cory Booker, when their campaigns have never really kind of taken off at all. You know, so it's like a little bit bizarre. You know, you're going to have most people lose in a primary of 23 candidates. And like,
but then isn't that why you would focus on the front runner who seems to be having trouble? Is the press going to spend a bunch of time asking why Amy Klobuchar never took off?
Maybe they should, though.
I don't know. That is an interesting question.
Or Harris. I mean, Harris. Like, what the hell is happening there?
I mean, I have seen the Harris
pieces. I mean, the Bernie folks don't like it when we say this, but like Bernie at 15%, he's down to, 14% in the Real Club Politics average, 14, 15, somewhere in there. You know, for Canada, they got 44% or 45% last time. That's not very good.
Hold on. More importantly, like, to the point that we're ultimately getting at here, do you think there are legitimate weaknesses in Biden's bid for the presidency, or do you think this is all media creation overhype?
I mean, those can both be true, right? I gave a presentation last week where it's like, okay, so Biden's weaknesses are profound, right? I put together a list, maybe I'll turn this into a 5-3 article, actually. I put together a list of six, the case for Biden against Biden, the case for Warren against Warren, right? And the case against Biden is a pretty good case, right? But let me give you the case for Biden, just play devil's advocate a bit here.
I also wrote a piece about that.
Still leads in national polls. I know. Still leads in national polls, barely. But barely, he does, probably. Still leads in endorsements by quite a bit. And Harris is second, not Warren. Has the most diverse coalition in the party by far. Has been a bit Teflon after repeated media predictions about his demise. Has an edge on perceived electability and polls best against Trump. Those polls don't matter, by the way. But but they help with the perception. And finally, he has the moderate lane mostly locked up for now. Those are six pretty powerful advantages. That's right. A decent case.
Here's going back to Claire's piece for a second. I think there was an assumption. Look, and let's disclosure if for those not watching on camera that we're four white people talking about this. But I think there was an assumption from mostly white people early on that Biden's black support was like incidental. It was sort of
it would go away.
Exactly. It would go away, especially when he had this sort of race freighted, to use a term we don't like, slubs.
Yeah.
Right. That hasn't really happened.
Yeah.
You've started to see in some polls Warren support go up among black voters, but only in some polls. Some polls don't show any movement. And I go back to actually a piece Perry wrote recently, which is a nice compliment to Claire's piece, about black voters sort of choosing the establishment candidate over a more liberal alternative, mm-hmm. as they have so far in the 2020 primary, is not unusual. It's kind of a repeated pattern, right? And what Perry writes about is two things. One is, well, the establishment candidate is established, right? They have like existing ties to the black community. And two, and this is a little tricky because like some polls show black voters describe themselves as more moderate.
Right.
the term Perry used, which I think is good, is like they're actually just more pragmatic. Claire got at this earlier. It's like from their point of view, it's like our voters really going to elect a woman or a non-white candidate after just electing Trump?
It's so interesting. That comes up all the time. I mean, there was a real sub-thread of I really like Elizabeth Warren, but a woman's going to lose to him. And I think this idea of a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberals, maybe a lot of people who are active on politics Twitter thinking, yes, black voters will sort of their support will seep away from Biden as it goes along. I mean, I do think that that is an interesting misreading. And the idea that black voters remain moderate, pragmatic, however you want to call it. But white Democratic voters have gotten much more rapidly self-identifying as liberal in the past, let's call it 10 years, than black voters have. And so there's almost this, I mean, we talk about it a lot, the woke white voter demographic kind of saying, well, listen, everyone's going to come around to us, to our view of hating on Biden. But there are quite a lot of people in the Democratic Party who do not feel that way and see a third Obama term in the body and person and campaign of Joe Biden. And Biden's campaign, to the point of parody and farce and imitation and whatever, always talking about Obama. They have these campaign videos where they all tweet out, we don't say it enough, Barack Obama was a great president,
which is
funny because people say it a lot. There are literally books called like Hugs from Obama. And like, so it's interesting to watch them. They have a strategy and they stick to it, and they will say, we don't care what Twitter says. This is our demographic and we're sticking to it.
And I do think even if Biden support among black voters eventually dissipates or is eaten into by Warren, I do think that early assumption from a lot of people that it was ephemeral, I think that's been proven wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's been there long enough through enough quote unquote controversies that's been proven wrong. At the same time, I don't think the Biden campaign is right that the questions about it are just like Twitter bullshit or whatever. Like, I think there are, even though he's led in polling this whole time, we're allowed to be like intelligent people and watch him in a debate or watch him on the trail and be like,
He's, I mean, and this is a thing that we maybe should have like a full segment on, but the idea of age and when.
Yeah.
When Biden talks about things, you know, there was this black college kid who I talked to at the very end. He kind of was pretty much considering supporting Biden. And he said, I really wanted to ask him a question about when he made that comment in Iowa about how poor kids are just as smart as white kids. And he was like, I know he didn't mean it to say that, but there's like implicit bias in there. And like, I wanted to ask him about how he plans on talking about his own implicit biases, right? And there is this sense of, especially with the top three contenders for the Democratic nomination, being people of fully just like, you know, a couple generations away from some of the people that they're looking to win votes from, there's a real dissonance there about how Biden talks about race or what stories he chooses to tell. And it works for some people, right? The idea that I think a lot of his appeal actually does lie in he doesn't talk like a woke Democrat.
Yeah.
And that woke talk makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And I think that that is a reality that Biden and his team probably understand on some level, while also understanding that, like, you could have a voter enthusiasm problem, too.
And that a lot of black voters are just like, yeah, we need someone who doesn't make white people
uncomfortable
in the Midwest.
Yeah, you described the moderation as also just pragmatic. But when you look at the issues, too, African-American voters are genuinely more conservative on some issues than their white liberal counterparts.
Well, so this is it's a really interesting question. And it's probably something we don't have that much time to get into. But black voters show up as more moderate in terms of self-identification, right? And they show up as more moderate, for instance, on the question of abortion. Does that mean they're sort of like more moderate in the way that matters in terms of the Democratic primary?
No, I think they actually are more moderate. I don't think it's a myth.
A more moderate
in what
way?
If you go look at questions on issues by issues and even on economic policy.
Yeah, faith, things
and,
like
and
that.
And part
too.
Of the reason why, imagine there's a kind of spectrum of opinions within the black community about taxes or whatever else, or economic policy. If every black voter, 92% of them are Democrat because of the historic relationship between Democrats and black voters and, frankly, Trump's stance on racial issues, then you're going to have a more diverse range of opinions on everything apart from, yeah, I'm a Democrat. And that kind of shows up if you look at issue by issue polling. I mean, I don't know, like in some sense, you know, if you think, oh, Biden's this really flawed candidate, then in some sense, the fact that he's still at 26% is more impressive. And maybe it's just that it is about like the fact that hey, this kind of old school, more modern message resonates with some voters. I guess my basic objection is, like, for a long time, you had early in the race people saying, well, Biden's lead's going to dissipate once X and Y happens. And a lot of times people predicted X and Y to happen and it didn't dissipate, or he recovered after a fall, right? And my view is always, hey, don't assume that he's going to fall much below where he is now, 30% or whatever. See if you can match 30%, because there's still 70% of the electorate left to draw from.
And that's largely what's happened.
And Warren is now at 25 or 26%. Maybe it's a little high, maybe 22 or 23, probably on our way, as far as we know, to 29, 30.
I think it's interesting to play out right now if Biden is still, despite whatever media coverage, one of two frontrunners. Warren is rising and perhaps has more of the media wind at her back. I think it's an interesting thing to consider. Okay, let's play out how the Democratic electorate reacts if Biden wins the nomination and goes on into the general election. And let's predict how the Democratic electorate reacts if Warren wins the nomination. Because I do think that there are different problems for people with each of them, right? I think the enthusiasm problem with Biden, right? Not that Democrats would be like, oh, I'm voting for Trump now. But just this idea of, I don't know how much Trump himself just makes people want to go out and vote. Probably a lot, but also you could see some people kind of tuning out. I mean, there are the sort of like Jill Stein voter types. On the other hand, if Warren wins the primary, you could see people getting really fretful about, well, geez, is she too liberal for the Midwest? And is she too much of a woman to win, right? Then you start getting into all these old 2016, is it a saw? An old saw? Whatever that phrase is. And it's interesting to watch, because I think there are some real questions from people about, wait, did, separate from the fact that she's a woman, did Elizabeth Warren go too far over the line with her healthcare plan, or, you know, things like that. And that starts to get into entirely different territory.
It's funny. There was somewhat of a debate, I think, between analysts over the past week or so on Twitter, like, are the frontrunners actually the strongest candidates in the race? And are some of the strongest candidates, like, more towards the bottom? But, and does it just mean simply because they're the frontrunners, they are the strongest? Like, is that how the primary works? The strongest comes to the top.
Well, it's interesting because I was in Wisconsin last week. Shout out the Upper Midwest.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, Badger State.
And I was in Madison, which is obviously, like, a Democratic stronghold in a pretty red state. And you would talk to people and everyone would give you the line, which was, I really like Elizabeth Warren. I don't think she can win Wisconsin. We should acknowledge that over the past couple of days, it's come out that Sanders
actually had
a heart attack, and the campaign didn't talk about it for a few days. The whole thing.
I mean, it's kind of nuts.
Yeah.
All right.
Can we also do a segment on what Nate said about black voters actually being moderate on economic stuff is super interesting. We should do it. Not at all.
I mean, moderate's a relative term. It's like,
no, of course,
they're sort of center left, not in like the Washington, D.C. think tank center left way.
We have a lot of things that we're going to do segments on. So maybe we should just start doing podcasts like every day or something. But let's leave things there for now. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And before we go, I want to remind listeners that we actually have a 538 store where you can get all kinds of merchandise. It's 538.com/store. An order is actually going out at the end of the day on Tuesday. So if you want to get some hats or t-shirts or tote bags soon, order by the end of Tuesday of this week. And actually, one more shout out before we end this podcast. We're actually working on a longer term project right now about how the primaries work. We have a kind of odd primary system in America. And so our intern, Jake Arlo, and I have spent some time investigating it, and it will be out in your feeds at some point in the future. But right now we need your help. We want to hear from you about what you think the best candidate selection system would be. Essentially, do you think the way we choose presidential nominees is a good system? You know, Iowa, New Hampshire, and then Nevada and South Carolina. Or do you think there's a better way of doing things? It's a little bit of a wonky question, but if you have some thoughts, send them our way. Record yourself on your cell phone as a voice memo and then send it to jake.arlo@abc.com. That's jake.arlo@abc.com. All right. Thanks a lot. My name is Galen Daruk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern, as you now know, is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. Although this week you should be emailing Jake with your thoughts about how our primary system works and how it maybe could be better. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.